Welcome to the weekend. Each week, I invite a keynote Sandler trainer to discuss the strategies to improve behavior, attitude, and techniques using the highly successful Sandler training system. This week, my guest is Dan Macias. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Jim. It's a real honor that you invited me and a pleasure to be with all of you.
And Dan hails from Bogota, Colombia. He grew up in Mexico. He has a Sandler franchise in Colombia, and he flies all over South America training Sandler. And I've invited him to share today a little bit about prospecting the millennial way. So Dan, tell us a little bit about what got you into Sandler and as lay a foundation for us.
Okay, perfect. Thank you so much, Jim. Before I graduated, when I was in college, I got into two or three jobs and I realized that in the particular field that I was working, I wasn't going to be getting paid enough. So I decided to start my own companies.
Ah, awesome.
And after 2 years of selling to everyone I knew, I didn't know how to sell to people I didn't know. So that was a problem. And sales just went down while I was thinking what to do without doing anything really. And a friend at a party told me, Dan, I just did this awesome training. These guys called Sandler Training. You definitely should call them.
Awesome.
So I did that. I was really desperate. And that's when I met the people at Sandler Monterrey in the north of Mexico. And they sold me the President's Club, the Sales Mastery Program.
Yeah, awesome.
So I got into that. I loved it. I got almost immediate results. And after a year and a half of starting with Sandler, I said, hey, I love this so much. I would love to coach this or to train this. So I started as a trainer. I still had my companies until I preferred selling Sandler than selling my graphic design services. That was what I was doing. And Jorge Saunders from Monterrey invited me to be part of the franchise in Monterrey.
That's awesome. And so you've been in Sandler how long now?
Well, I started as a client in 2011. So that's almost 6 years and almost 4 years being part of the network.
And Dan has been really a rising star in our business. He's managed to capture a lot of clients, been really great at building his book of business. So I want to tap into your wealth of knowledge, Dan. How do you go about building a book of business when you don't know anybody?
Well, yeah, that's an excellent point. I founded four companies before getting into Sandler. So before being in Sandler, I had started from scratch almost four times.
Yeah.
And then 9 months after being in Sandler Monterrey, they invited me to move to Colombia. And that was probably the first time that I really started from scratch. And it was really interesting moment to know myself better,
right,
and be a behavior animal. And yeah, as I had nothing else to do, my goal was to do at least 30 calls every day or 30 contact attempts.
Yeah.
I didn't care if they worked or not. If someone didn't pick up the call, I marked it as one of the 30. And that started building the inertia I needed.
Right.
And I started getting plenty of appointments, from 4 to 6 new appointments every week. After 3 months, 4 months, the business started to be there, because for the first 4 months, the truth is there was a guy making cold calls. No, right. No business at all, right?
At that point, are you making cold calls to build your Sandler business?
That was exclusively Sandler. When I got into Colombia, the only thing I was doing was Sandler, and I did a lot of cold calls, used LinkedIn to get the contacts of people, and I started to look for as many networking events as I could, and also try to build some strategic partnerships with startup accelerators, with co-working spaces where a lot of small and medium companies have their offices. So doing a combination, all of that, that's how I managed to start building a decent business.
Yeah, anybody who's listening to us, if you've ever started a business from ground zero, there comes a point when your business outgrows your sphere of influence. So I've tapped into everybody I know. And at some point, I got to get out in front of people who I don't know. And there's a lot of ways you can do that. You can buy advertising. You can spend money on marketing. You can go to networking events. A lot of different strategies that can go into building your brand. But the one thing that I think is the most difficult and also the most effective is that dialing for dollars prospecting. One thing David Sandler says is cold calling is effective because so few people do it well. So here we have Dan doing cold calling using the Sandler technique. How long did it take you, Dan, before you felt like, okay, I'm actually using the Sandler process to make these calls and getting some traction?
I guess when I started training with Sandler, it probably took me, I would say, 2 months, 2 months and a half that I started feeling really comfortable with the cold call. And then when I changed my business, you know, from being in my own companies to moving into the Sandler franchise, it was probably quicker. You know, when you get the feeling of how to create a 30-second commercial, then you get pretty good at creating a 30-second commercial for any product or for any company. So it probably took me, you know, a couple of weeks to feel comfortable with my Sandler 30-second commercial that, by the way, it's not mine. I stole it.
Right.
And that's something I recommend to everyone. Sometimes you want to build your own and you got a friend or you got a partner that already has a 30-second commercial that's working. You can start with that and probably, you know, add a couple of words that are your own style.
Yeah.
And that's more than enough to start with.
It requires guts and courage. So Dan's got a long list of things he wants to cover today. We're talking specifically about millennial style marketing. So what are some of the things from a prospecting perspective, Dan, that you have found effective in really equipping a millennial to be successful wearing that sales prospecting hat?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think millennials, although I don't look so millennial because life hasn't treated me well enough lately, but I am a millennial. Just do what you already do. What do millennials do a lot? We use a lot of social media. That's the way that we communicate with our family. That's the way we communicate with our friends. That's the way we stay in touch with people we met in college or in whatever trip, if you met someone. So you gotta integrate your prospecting to your usual way of communicating.
Ah.
So using Facebook, using Instagram, using any message application that you use, if you use iMessage or if you use WhatsApp, try to build all of that into your prospecting. And that gives amazing results. And it has a multiplier effect that traditional prospecting doesn't have.
So take us back to the beginning. Let's say I want to build a network. How do I identify who is my ideal client? And then what does that first outreach sound like?
Well, I would say, first of all, what you got to do is start publishing in your social media what you already do. For example, something that I do is that every time I do some training, I ask one of the participants to take some pictures of me doing the training. And then I take some pictures of the classroom and, you know, people being happy. I always tell them, smile, you know, look as if you're enjoying this. Post that in your social media. Yeah. Post that in your LinkedIn. Post that in your Facebook. And what that creates is you start creating your personal brand where people know what you do and that you're good at it. You got to think that your friends and your family, those are the people that trust in you the most. They already like you. What you want to do is that every time they have the opportunity to recommend you, to send you a referral, you want to be in their top of mind. And you do that by constantly sending the message, I do this and I'm great at this. So
awesome.
That creates kind of a natural selection of people that start calling you or messaging you instead of you reaching out to them. So that would be the first step.
So you got to be willing to be a self-promoter. You got to be willing to let the world see what you're doing. My guest today is Dan Macias. Dan, give your contact information in case one of our listeners would like to reach out to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. So you can find me in social media, in Facebook, in LinkedIn, in Instagram as Dan Macias. Macias is MACIAS. And my Sandler email is Daniel.Macias@ at Sandler.com.
All right. I'm Idaho Sandler trainer Jim Stevens. Visit our website at www.crossroads.sandler.com and download our free book, Why Salespeople Fail and What You Can Do About It. This is Sandler Training, finding power in reinforcement. Welcome to Entrepreneur Radio, where we get to learn more about my heroes of society, individual business owners and leaders. Did you realize that 60% of the population work for small business owners? I think that they are the engine that drives business. And in this program, we get to hear their stories and learn from some of their challenges, hardships, successes, and victories. I have as my guest today, Josiah Stevens, my son, and he is the owner of Stronghold Remodeling. Welcome, Josiah.
Thank you.
Very interesting to have my son on the program because, and I want to talk a little bit about career path, because I remember, Josiah, when you were little, we lived in multiple homes that we remodeled, and you were my shadow. You worked with me side by side, never really intending, I don't think, to get into remodeling. Went to school at Whitman, majored in studio art, and now here you are running Stronghold. How did that happen?
Well, that came about just from kind of one of the old struggles of being an artist and needing to make money.
Right.
And you kind of make a choice of you're either going to hustle your art to people and push to have people buy it or get a second job to provide income. And I feel like the route that most people are going to take is to get that second job and provide income. And then the art becomes something that you just do because you love to do it.
Right. And it's interesting how in your role in Stronghold, you're engaging your artistic skill set. So describe for the listeners what it is you do within Stronghold.
So I'm the first point of contact with clients, and I go into the home and help them kind of flesh out exactly what they want to achieve with a remodeling project and then build a plan based on that. I use CAD and come up with, you know, good visuals, 3D drawings, and use the computer to kind of really make an image of what they want their space to look like. And then if we come to agreement on budget and timing and all of that, then we execute the project.
Awesome. And how much of your designing do you feel stimulates that artistic passion you have?
Probably a lot of it. When you boil down art, it's simply about arranging things. At least for me, for a lot of people, it's about the relationships between objects, whether it's paint and colors and whatever. And then in doing a design plan, that's a lot of what you're taking into account too, is that just those relationships and how they're going to work together.
And so when you're at someone's home, describe the process you go through when somebody says, hey, I'm curious.
I like to first talk to them about kind of my design process, which is to just have a conversation and uncover as many constraints as we can. And constraints are things that are going to have to be true in order for the design to be successful, right? So like a very basic constraint is that a bathroom needs to have a toilet and a sink and probably a shower, but sometimes it's a powder bath, right?
Right.
So there's these really basic constraints. And then the floor plan that we're working in, if we're doing a remodel, that's a constraint. The budget is a big constraint that we have to talk about, and we have to spend time determining what that constraint is. And so the design's aesthetic, what they want it to look like, how they want to feel when they walk into it, I consider that to be a constraint. So as we're talking, I just try to keep track of, here's all the things that I have to work with compared to a painting. Here's all the colors that I'm going to be working with on my palette. And then I go back and move them around and arrange them until it fits.
It's interesting you use that term constraint, because doesn't a constraint force a whole different level of creativity in reference to art?
Yeah, exactly. I don't know who said this, but you know, the hardest brush stroke or line you're going to make is when it's on the blank canvas. Right. So those first lines are always really hard to make because you don't have anything to reference. They're just existing on their own and they're always going to be wrong.
Yeah. Writer's block, painter's block. Keep staring at that blank screen and there's nothing I can see coming out of it.
But then once you start adding and adding and you get all these structures, then the marks come a lot easier because you're working within something, trying to understand it.
So when you're taking someone who's interested in a remodeling project through this process, do you introduce them to the concept of constraints and why it's important to identify them and then work within them?
Yeah, I talk about it similar to how we've just talked about it.
I like the word
constraint because it, what are some synonyms I've used before, like targets or goals or those
road
sort of things?
Or constriction points.
Yeah, but when you start thinking about it as constraints, it's just, I feel like it strips away a lot of those things we feel like we can adjust. Like we can adjust what, if we're talking about budget, I feel like that's a little bit flexible. If I talk about a constraint, that's not flexible. That's something I have to work with. within.
Yeah.
So it allows me to be very honest about stuff like that, because I know, like, I won't try to design a project unless I feel like I can work within the constraints, which can get me into trouble sometimes, because, like, if you tell me you want a $50,000 kitchen and it's a house that needs a $100,000 kitchen, because you can't put a $50,000 kitchen in every house.
$100,000 house.
Yeah. Or in a, yeah, in a $1 million house, yeah. Whatever, then I'll politely decline. But there is, you know, I know I could build a kitchen for that space, but it's not going to fit what you want.
Yeah, it's not going to retain the integrity of the home.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool. I do like that term constraint too, and it allows you to discuss on whether they are variable or restricted. And so many constraints that happen in remodeling, you don't know until you tear open the house. Like, is a wall bearing? Is there plumbing in it? So how do you deal with those kind of hidden constraints?
Well, we try to figure out as many of them as we can beforehand. But yeah, I do have a conversation about that, because it'll change things dramatically if we figure out, like, if our budget's really set and then we open the wall and there's something we didn't know about that's going to cost $5,000 to change, suddenly there's a new constraint and we have to go back to the drawing board, figure out if there's another option, or if, you know, cut somewhere else, move the budget. Constraints can be moved, I suppose.
And so in remodeling, when I was actively involved, I always saw it as a co-creative effort, because my job was to take the wishes of the client and help them create the outcome they wanted. So talk to us about the collaboration that you typically go through with a client.
Yeah, I think to a large extent, you know, what I do is really I'm acting as a translator. And I'm trying to listen well to their words, you know, look at pictures together, and then come back with, like, the visuals, the plans, the language that meets what they're telling me. And I don't see that as not a creative process, because language and everything is so creative.
Also
there's so much room in between words when you're having those conversations with people about almost anything. Like, what you're seeing when you're giving me a description of a space versus what I'm hearing is always going to be a little bit different. But by, you know, repeating back and listening well and coming back with drawings, I feel like we can, you know, come close to having a shared vision.
And everybody takes in the world differently. Some of us are visuals, in which case those 3D images would be very helpful. Some people are auditory. They need to hear what you're creating, and then the kinesthetics need to feel it. So how do you, when you're presenting what you've come up with, are you engaging all of those modalities? And how are you translating your vision in a description that they can resonate with?
I'm definitely leaning heavily on the visual aspect of the whole process, but you can get into the kinesthetic by bringing in samples or, you know, going shopping together. That can really engage some people, and it's something that always needs to happen. And then as far as auditory goes, it's the conversation and the both reading and talking back and forth about the project.
Yeah, and that auditory listener really wants to talk their way through it. So getting them to talk through the emotion of how will you use this?
Yeah.
So remodeling is notoriously difficult, right? It can be a stretch for the clients. It's a challenge for the contractor. What are some of the things that you think you do in Stronghold that helps abate or minimize the stressors that come?
I think the most important things are kind of what you always taught me early on, and I always tell the guys, everybody knows when their house looks messy versus when it looks clean. So we just clean up at the end of the day and organize our stuff and get ready to come back the next day. It does always seem there's always roadblocks and things take longer than we planned. And typically clients are very understanding of a lot of that if the site's clean, if we've shown up every day.
Yeah, right.
As soon as you left it a mess and you didn't show up, I don't think you get much sympathy.
That's a great point. Probably because you haven't earned much sympathy there. And so the typical process, what would you say are some of the pitfalls that or mistakes people make that you've observed in doing remodeling projects? You mentioned one earlier, and that is not spending enough money. And it is possible to go into a project, and if I'm only willing to spend $50,000, but it's not going to look right if I don't spend more, I think that's a wake-up call that a homeowner needs to hear. What are some other examples of those challenges that a homeowner is going to have to process through when they engage in your services?
It's a good question. I like to talk a lot about aesthetics versus utilitarian, and I always err on the side of utilitarian. So sometimes I'll have, like, long discussions with clients about, like, we've come up with their vision and there's just certain things that aren't going to be useful in the long term. Like, I can tell it's going to be annoying to have these, like, small obstacles on the floor plan or, like, how things are connecting, where I think, you know, if we can modify this plan to make it more functional, even though at the cost of maybe some aesthetic, mm-hmm. we should do that. Mm-hmm. So I think that could be a pitfall of just looking for the aesthetic. And then I'm sure there's a pitfall the other way where you just wanted the functional space and you don't care about the aesthetic. So there's a middle ground there that has to be fixed as well.
Yeah.
And then another thing that I've found that can change a lot during a remodel is when you start, you know, we've talked extensively about your motivations, like why you want to do this. And then as we go through, it seems like, you know, maybe the motivation was really something a little bit different, or things have come up or things have changed.
Yeah.
So we end up, you know, we've completely redone a house where we thought we were just going to do a bathroom. And so, you know, the motivations obviously changed. The budgets, of course, changed at that point.
Yeah.
So I'm looking back and I'm like, wow, if we knew at the beginning that we were going to do this, what a different process it would have been.
Right.
But I don't know if it would have been possible to start the job if we started
to do the whole thing. Yeah, yeah. Right, right, right. Now, people, I think, generally buy incrementally and we give ourselves permission one step at a time. But then, like you said, if we had the foresight to know we were going to go here, we maybe could have been more efficient or had a different outcome. So only got a few minutes remaining. Share with the listeners, as an entrepreneur, what's your vision for the future? What are you seeing in the evolution of Stronghold that kind of excites you about the future?
Well, I think I've seen like a lot of new products come onto the market and a lot of, you know, changes in the way competitors and subcontractors do things. And since I've gone and seen tons of old projects that Stronghold has done before I was involved. And one thing I've always noticed is like that you just can't fake or have the timeless quality of like just really good craftsmanship. Yeah. There is this feeling that I get from people that, hey, we don't need to go to that extent. We don't need the best stuff. And I just very adamant that no, we don't. We just need really, really high grade craftsmanship on every part of the project. Because if we do that, you know, if the colors change, you have to paint it in 20 years, that's no big deal. But if we use junk, it's not going to last. It just gets torn out in 15 years. There's kind of no point. Let's do something that's going to be there for the long haul, that's going to be really high quality.
I love that thought, timeless quality. I mean, that's so true. Timeless craftsmanship. Give your contact information, Josiah, in case somebody'd like to reach out to you and have a conversation.
My name is Josiah Stevens. I'm with Stronghold Remodeling, and you could reach me at 208-340-6967.
One more time, that phone number?
208-340-6967.
On Entrepreneur Radio, we share the stories of leaders and individuals who drive change to see how they've achieved success. If you like our content, you can go to our website at crossroads.sandler.com and see how we can help you. So far, we've been speaking with Sandler trainer Dan Macias. Now we're going to ask him to take us into a little more detail to walk us through some of the steps to better understand the conceptual behind millennial style prospecting. Dan, take it away.
Sure. Thanks, Jim. So I would like to talk to you about how to prospect through social media. And then after that, I would like to talk to you about also real world prospecting, right? Like prospecting,
awesome.
Being in front of people, because you also have to be an expert at that.
Good.
As we were saying, being a millennial, we already use social media. And of course, you don't have to be a millennial to use social media. I've met people that have been a little bit resistant to social media. And I would say they're leaving a lot of money on the table.
Mm.
Use the social media that you like the most. I use three. Basically, I use Facebook, I use LinkedIn, and I use Instagram. To tell you the truth, I tried to use Twitter. I tried to use Snapchat. It just didn't go with me. So I don't waste time trying to learn that stuff. And probably I'll regret it at some point.
Right.
But I'm using those three, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. So what do I do on Facebook? I think it's important that I say this. As you know, I live in Latin America. I live in South America. I'm going to do training in 11 countries this year, 10 of them Spanish speaking. So I'm prospect in a Latin vibe world. Mm. And Latin people are very warm people. They want to feel close to you. Even the physical space, when you are talking to someone from a Latin American country, they get closer to you than people from other countries. Okay. So one of the things that I try to do is try to emulate that into social media. So for example, when it's the second time I deliver training for a certain client, I start adding those clients is on my personal Facebook.
Yeah.
Right? I start asking them to add me as a friend. I tell them also, if you like me, add me on Facebook. I will add you on Facebook. If I didn't like you, I won't accept you. And people laugh. And I'm building this big friend base on Facebook. Right now, I have probably like 2,400 friends on Facebook.
Wow.
And I use that as a personal branding tool.
So how often are you posting on Facebook?
Great question. So I try to do it 3 to 4 times per week. I usually do only one post per day.
Yeah.
In my understanding, if you're a corporate, if you have a corporate page, if you are promoting your business, you should be posting more often. But as this is my personal page, I love self-promotion, but I try to be not so much.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And also what I try to do is interact with them. So if they post their own pictures, their own vacations, it's their son's or daughter's birthday, or it's their anniversary, you give them likes, okay? Now Facebook has not only likes, it has hearts and it has laughs and all that stuff. Yeah. Interact with them. Make them notice that you care about what they're posting.
As you're doing this, Stan, are you consciously identifying, here's the top 50 people I want to do business with, so I'm actually going to their page and liking them, or are you just reading through the string and liking sporadically whoever is posting?
Well, that's a very good point. The people that are already in my Facebook are already my clients. And what I want to do is to strengthen the relationship. Mm. I don't look for prospects on Facebook. I only do it with people that already know me, because Facebook is an intimate social media. Okay.
Good.
You post your personal life. So that's for the clients that where I want to strengthen the relationship. As I told you that the Latin vibe is, I want to try to turn them to more than clients. I want to start befriending my clients. And I would say it's a natural process, because not all of them add you.
Right.
Only the ones that really like you add you or accept you.
Right.
So it's interesting, because there's a process where you like them and they like you. You comment in their pictures. They comment in your pictures. Something that's part of my cookbook is every day I check birthdays on Facebook. And something that I do is I write them a message via Facebook message or via iMessage or WhatsApp. I don't post on their wall, because everyone posts on their wall. So what I do is try to do something different by sending them a personal message through other channel. And it's interesting that people get excited now because of that. Like,
yeah,
if you write them a personal message, they get excited that you weren't like the rest of the people that just wrote,
put a thumbs up. Yeah. Happy birthday.
Wall,
whatever.
Right?
Yeah. So I'm guessing when it comes to actual prospecting, you're using LinkedIn more for that. Talk to us about that.
That's correct. So I believe LinkedIn is an awesome tool. To tell you the truth, I haven't gotten enough into LinkedIn. I don't have a premium account, for example.
Right.
I have the free account. So I prospect in two ways. I would say passive prospecting, doing the same that I do on Facebook. Actually, the same pictures that I post on Facebook are the ones that I post on Instagram and the ones that I post on LinkedIn. I think that any social media expert would hate me because of what I do, because the correct way of doing it is posting different content in the social media.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is, I like to keep myself busy, and I do this in kind of my free time or my breaks. So I do it as practically as I can.
Yeah.
I post the pictures. I also add all of my clients on LinkedIn. And also in my prospecting time, that I have an hour that I call my sacred prospecting hour. And I try to have at least 2 or 3 of those during my week. And before that, I have my sacred research hour.
Mm.
So I never prospect without doing a little bit of research first. When I prospect, I want to have all the phones written down so I don't waste time seeing who I'm going to call. And in that prospecting, in that sacred research hour, I go to the search bar on LinkedIn and just type in CEO or sales manager that they're basically the two positions I want to talk to. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I go to HR manager. And as you know, LinkedIn automatically sends you the people that are closest to you that have that position.
Right.
And then I just go into their profiles, check a little bit of their story, go into the company's website. And with that, I can notice if it's a company that would be a good prospect or is not a good prospect. And then if these people post their cell phone, I call their cell phone. If they don't, I go to Facebook and ask who works in this company. Yeah. Or I check my mutual connections and see if there's someone I know that can refer me to this guy. Mm. And if I don't get any of that, yet that usually I do get a connection, I just call the company's phone and do the traditional cold call process that you can be as millennial as you want, but you still have to be great at doing a cold call because you're going to need it at some point.
That's awesome. So we've only got maybe a minute or so left in this session. What are the high level things that maybe we've missed, Dan, that you'd like to call our attention to?
It's very important. You talked about self-promotion earlier. I think it's very important not to have the wrong idea about self-promotion. Being a good self-promoter doesn't mean that you are not a humble person.
Right.
It means that you are a business person with vision and that you understand that personal branding is a key to building a company as other important matters. So I would say if you feel that you're not comfortable with self-promotion, think that you're definitely, there's a lot of people that are looking for you. And because you're not promoting yourself, they're not finding you.
Yeah.
And they're finding someone else that's not solving their problem as good as you could solve their problem.
Wow, that is a great belief system to add as a foundation to give yourself permission to reach out and be a little bit more transparent.
Totally.
Anything else?
Totally. And I would say try to build real relationships. I feel that sometimes people have this belief system that you had to separate business from personal. I don't know if this is appropriate for me to say, but I really try to become friend of my clients.
I agree with
that. And that has been a great business and life strategy.
Dan Macias is my guest today. Dan, give your contact information in case there's somebody who'd like to reach out and have a conversation with you.
Sure, thanks. I would love that. You can find me in social media, Facebook, LinkedIn, or Instagram as Dan Macias. My last name is Macias, and my email is daniel.macias@sandler.com.
And I'm Idaho's CEO of Sandler Training, Jim Stevens. If you like this show and want to subscribe to our content, visit us at crossroads.sandler.com/podcast or reach out to us at 208-429-9275. This is Sandler Training, finding power in reinforcement. So far, we've talked about the conceptual, but I'd like us to get into the technical, Dan. I don't suppose you'd take us through some of the technical execution of the things you've been talking about, would you?
Sure, sure. I would like to talk to you about, Jim, real-world prospecting, okay? We've talked a lot about social media and creating your personal brand so that people know what you're doing, so they look for you, but you also have to reach out to people.
Right.
And one of the things that I had to do, not because I liked it, but because I had to do it when I came to Colombia, knowing absolutely no one, is going to networking events. And to tell you the truth, I don't like networking events.
Amen to that. I don't either. We share that in common.
Yes, yes. I appreciate that. I don't feel so strange on my own right now.
Yeah, one of our rules in Sandler is you don't have to like prospecting. You just have to do it. And it's the same with networking. You don't have to like it. You just have to do it.
That's correct. But I think there's a life hack that I found for me not to suffer as much doing networking. And that's instead of going to that traditional event where someone gives a talk and then you have a networking space and you have a sticker on you and, you know, what do you do, whatever. And, you know, you're looking for the guy that looks as lonely as you. What I found is structured networking events. So some startup accelerators, some organizations have events where they give you a couple of minutes to say who you are, what you do, and what are you looking for at that event. And I found that that format worked for me perfectly because it removed all the pressure of trying to look for someone that doesn't want to talk to you.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So what I said in these events, as I was new in Colombia, is being disarmingly honest as we do it in Sandler. So they give me my 2 minutes and I said, my name is Dan Macias. I'm a Mexican. This is my third week in Colombia. And I'm here because I'm opening Sandler Training's offices. And Sandler Training is the largest training company in the world. And I said my 30-second commercial. And after that, I said, what am I looking for? I'm looking, of course, for clients. I'm looking for partnerships. But especially, the truth is, I'm looking for friends. Because, as I said, it's my third week in Colombia. I don't know anyone. My wife that's sitting beside me is super social, super extroverted, and we've been here without doing nothing but talking only to ourselves, and she's getting cranky. So, guys, if anyone is willing, I will pay the beers tonight. And people laughed, and they thought that I was joking, but I wasn't joking. I was really desperate at that point. And actually, people came to me after that, and some of them accepted the offer, and that has brought me business,
right.
Actually.
And I love that disarmingly honest is the one thing that really drew me to Sandler in the first place and keeps me very passionate about it, because it eliminates a lot of the game playing. You could even say in a networking event, introduce yourself, give your 30-second commercial, and say something like, you know, I don't even like networking events, but I'm hoping there might be somebody here who doesn't like them with me. We could chat a little later. Whatever, it doesn't matter. But being disarmingly honest is one of the great strategies in the Sandler playbook.
That's right. I just love it. I just love it. And I think you got to be also disarmingly honest with yourself and realize what kind of prospecting works for you.
Right.
Sometimes we put a lot of pressure on ourselves because our coach or our friend is great at certain type of prospecting, and you just try to match what he's doing, and you probably have to find your own style and find the events or the style of prospecting that you're more comfortable with.
Any other practical applications? Like maybe we should perhaps give an example of what does, you talk about the pattern interrupt and cold calling. We got to do something so that they are a little bit off guard, disarmed, and then we need to use our 30-second commercial to engage people emotionally. So take us through maybe even a practice session. If you were dialing for dollars, cold calling me, what's that going to sound like?
Yeah, sure. So pick up the phone, Jim.
Ring, ring, ring. Hello, this is Jim.
Hi, Jim. Are you busy? Do I catch you at a bad time?
I am busy, yes, but this is okay. What's this about?
Sure, Jim. This is Dan Macias. We don't know each other. I wanted to see if you have a couple of minutes just to tell you the reason of why I'm calling. In the end, you can hang up the phone or you can decide if we can keep on talking. Are you okay with that?
Okay, I'll give you a couple minutes.
Sure. Jim, I'm calling you from Sandler Training. Sandler is the largest training company in the world for sales and management. And what we do is we work with companies that are not 100% satisfied with their sales results, or probably they are, but they still want more. And they notice that probably they have some salespeople in their comfort zone or people that are order takers and are not going out to look for clients, or salespeople that know perfectly all the technical information about their products, but probably they don't have the sales techniques to sell those products. I don't know if any of these rings a bell, Jim.
Well, I think certainly the comfort zone, right? I've got some people that I know they could do better. It feels like they're just resting on their laurels and waiting for the phone to ring.
Okay.
So I would say, yeah, I'm marginally interested. I mean, we're having a pretty good year here.
But
I think there can always be more, and I always want more.
Okay, that's great. So you say comfort zone. That usually happens with salespeople. You know, we hear salespeople are are probably difficult kind of people. So and you say you're also, you're having a pretty good year. So I would ask you, do you think having your salespeople, some of your salespeople in a comfort zone could be affecting you or the company in some way?
Yeah, definitely. I think if they were a little more proactive, and we could sure build a bigger backlog of business.
Okay. Okay. Interesting. Now, you said before, Jim, you're having a pretty good year. Would it be interesting for you? I don't know. But would it be interesting for you if we sit a little bit, have a little bit longer conversation to see if there's something that probably we can do together? In the end, probably nothing will happen, but at least we get to know each other.
Yeah, I think that's probably okay. I'm pretty busy the next couple of weeks.
No problem. I'm not in any rush. If you're not available in the next couple of weeks, we can book probably in 3 weeks from now on. I don't know if that's too far for you or if it's okay if we schedule a meeting for the next 3 weeks.
Awesome. Awesome. Great job. So let's unpack that a little bit for our listeners. The first thing I heard is the pattern interrupt. Did I catch you at a bad time? And when somebody calls and says to me, is this a good time? I respond with, for what? But when you say, did I catch you at a bad time? Well, it's not a bad time, but what do you want? I mean, it's just a little more disarming. And,
right,
and then
right,
the second
right.
thing Dan did is he said who he is and said, look, I don't know if there's any reason for us to have a conversation. Would it be okay to take a couple of minutes? I'll just share with you why I called. You decide if we keep talking or not. Either way is good for me. And then his 30-second commercial was built around the emotional impact that a manager or business owner who wants to grow revenue has, and it's designed to pique my interest, and those were all generic or neutral enough that it'd be hard for any sales manager or business owner to say no to that. Any of your thoughts on what you would call our attention to, Dan?
I would say a couple of things. First is that I don't like saying the name of my company in the first part. I like to leave that for the 30-second commercial.
Good.
Because I want him to be curious.
Curious.
Okay? Yeah. I want him to say, this is a weird call, but I want to keep listening at least to understand who is this guy, okay?
Yeah.
And the other thing is that if you want to soften the call a little bit, if you don't want it to be so cold, and you it's good for you to name where you got the contact from, it's okay after you say, hey, this is Dan Macias, we don't know each other. I got your contact from LinkedIn.
Yeah.
Or I got your contact because Jim Stevens told me I should call you.
Yeah.
That makes the call a little bit warmer and keeps the interest on the listener.
Great stuff, Dan. My guest today is Dan Macias. He's been sharing with us how to millennial style prospecting. Dan, this has been great information. Share with us your contact information in case one of our listeners would like to reach out to you.
Sure. It would be a pleasure. You can find me in social media as Dan Macias. Yes, on LinkedIn, on Facebook, or on Instagram, Dan Macias, that's M-A-C-I-A-S. Or you can shoot me an email at daniel.macias@sandler.com.
This is Jim Stevens with Sandler Training. If you'd like to receive my weekly tip on how to jumpstart your professional development, sign up at crossroads.sandler.com. This is Sandler Training, where you find power in reinforcement. Welcome back to the Sandler Training Hour. I'm with Sandler trainer Dan Macias. Now, Dan, Sandler is a trial of ongoing reinforcement and commitment. I'd like you to walk through some of the frustrations, concerns, or intimacies that have developed in your life through this learned transparency.
I'll take that question to keep reflecting on that. You know, sometimes we're too excited on
right.
working our business, and we don't reflect enough on what else do we need to be better at. I think, although the submarine is a pretty straightforward 7-step process, and I've been practicing it for 6 years, there's still stuff that I know I need to be better at. And also applying it to the Latin American style, you need to adapt some stuff. For example, I still struggle with the budget step. I'm good at getting enough pain, and I'm really good to turning that pain into numbers so I can know perfectly if people are losing 1 million, 5 million, or 10 million bucks because their people are not prepared enough. But then some difference that I've noticed is that some Latin American people are not so willing to invest a reasonable amount of money on solving that problem.
Yeah.
So when I listen, you know, to the tapes and to the trainings that you guys do, and I see that you ask, hey, if we were able to solve that $1 million problem for you, how much of that would you be willing to invest to solve it? And you get answers, you know, people that say, I would invest 50%, 40%, 30%, you know, a decent amount, because they don't have that $1 million. In Latin America, you get responses like 1%. Half percent. And you're like, really? It's $1 million. You don't have them, and we'll solve that for you? Yeah, but more than 1% would be too much money.
Really?
So you got to ask, you got to make them realize how they sound.
Yeah.
I would say there's a lot of business people. Of course, there's a lot of great businessmen that are willing to invest enough money. And that's why we have a great business down here. Okay.
All right.
But there's a lot of average business owners that don't have this sense of investing to get a return.
Right.
So that's a huge struggle that we've been trying, you know, to work out.
Yeah, in a case like that, you really have to help your buyer recognize how silly they sound. I had somebody in my training today, in fact, and she was talking to a buyer about buying something, and the buyer gave a number that was like 1/3 of the what it would cost. And my client's response was, oh, that's cute. Right? A little bit sarcastic. And I said, well, how did she respond to that? And she said she was a little stunned for a minute, and then she laughed because she could hear how absurd that was. And it really is. I got to do something to wake these people up. Let me get this straight. You're bleeding $1 million every year. You need stitches the length of your arm, and you only want me to put in one stitch. Is that what you're saying? Right? So what strategies have you used to get over that?
So first of all, and I'm still not comfortable with this call I made, but I started understanding that in the end, the Sandler process is about qualifying, and it's about adapting the solution to the pain, budget, and decision. So I've been adapting my solutions to the budget that people have available, you know. So I live constantly selling monkey's paws.
Yeah.
You know, sell today, educate tomorrow. Because sometimes even when you say those comebacks as your client did, that I think it's awesome, they say, you know, I know it's cute, but it's what it's available.
Right.
So let's start and let's see what happens from then on.
Yeah.
That's a concept struggle that I have. And I still don't know if I'm really adapting to the market or if my head trash is just playing games with me and it's making me do things that I shouldn't do.
It's funny that you bring this up because I have the exact opposite problem. Somebody gives me a weak number in the budget step and I'm just ready to flush them. And I want to sell them all or nothing. I say things like this. You know, I often have people who come to me and ask me for an abbreviated version of what I do. And I think I could do you more harm than good because you'll have enough to be dangerous, but not enough to be consistent.
Okay.
And in that point, I'm not sure I've really helped you. So unless you're willing to spend more money, I think we're done. Your thoughts. And I throw that back at him. But I think I listen to what you're saying, and I think I probably am disqualifying people too soon because they really do have a legitimate mental block against making, for example, in Sandler, if you've never made an investment in yourself, if you've never hired a consultant to help you, it's kind of hard to peel money out of your wallet for that because you have no idea what you're getting. So you know, I think for me, I could take a page out of your page book and allow them to buy what they want, not what I think they should buy. So I think the answer probably lays somewhere there in the middle.
Yeah, I agree. I would say that as a business owner, you have to ask yourself, am I at the point of my business where I can easily disqualify prospects and only get the prospects that buy the full product? Or the truth is, I'm at a point where I need income.
Right.
And probably I need to be more flexible. Right. One of my sales mastery clients just had that experience and he was amazed and he was truly grateful because he wanted to sell the whole consulting package. And he just had a list of like 20 prospects when that, even after all the pain, when he talked about budget, everyone backed down. So we started not selling cheaper products, just selling parts, a part of the product.
Yeah, a bite-sized chunk.
That's right. And that already started working, and he's really excited because the money is in his pocket right now.
Yeah, that's awesome. So we only have a couple of minutes left, Dan, and I want to pick your brain a little bit. Dan's a millennial, if you weren't listening to the earlier part of our program. He gave us some great strategies and tactics on millennial-style prospecting. Give us a couple of strategies, Dan, on how to manage a millennial. For me, as a manager, I don't know what the disconnect is, but I'd love to have some of your insights.
Sure. Thanks for that question. I've been managed as a millennial that I am, and I also manage millennials, and I train my clients to manage millennials. And I would say I found four keys that if you use them managing millennials, you will have no trouble. Before that, I want to say it's very important that we don't think as millennials as a bad professional. You know, millennials have a bad reputation
with
some other generations, but there's tons of millennials that are really awesome at what they do when these four things are met.
Love it.
And I would say the main thing, the first thing I want to say is that a millennial has to be somewhere where he's passionate about what he's doing. And that's not what other generations look for. Probably they look for stability. Probably they look for income. And they were capable of adapting of what they were doing, of what industry they were working on.
Yeah.
And I think we millennials, we like to do what we love.
Love it.
We have a problem, and it's that sometimes we don't know what that is.
Good point.
So we got to help them understand what that is.
What is their passion?
As managers, understanding that probably the millennial is not going to be there for 3 or 5 or 10 years. He's going to be probably there for a couple of years, maybe even for 1 year. And I think we have to change the mindset from being, I want to keep you and I want to train you and I want to invest in you only if you stay with me. We got to change that to, in this time that we're going to be together, let's have a profitable relationship for both sides.
Great strategy.
I will invest all that I have in you so that you can develop yourself, find what you're passionate about, become a better professional. And in exchange, I ask you that you give everything that you can, all your energy, all your drive, all your creativity in this company.
Love
and
that.
In that relationship, we know it's going to end at some point, but we will part being friends.
Love that. So is that the second point?
So that's fourth point, actually.
Okay, that's all right. What else?
I'm too structured. Sorry for that.
No, that's okay.
That's the second point, understanding how you are helping them, okay? So first, understand their passions and hire people that are passionate about
what you're hiring them for.
Not only for income, not only because they're desperate. The second is understand their life goals so that you can help them develop themselves towards their life goals. And that means probably you'll find people that they want to be upfront, and that's what you want. They want to be upfront and say, hey, then in 2 years, I want to go to travel the world on my own.
Mm.
Or in 2 years, I want to move to another continent to study whatever. And our reaction shouldn't be like, why are you leaving? Our reaction should be, okay, that's awesome. How can we help you as a company so that you feel happy and that you help us bring profit? That's what we're looking for.
Great idea.
So yeah, that's the second one. The third one is time flexibility. I read a book called Making Ideas Happen from Scott Belsky. And he says something that I've used as a life rule. You can have a fixed schedule and flexible goals, or you can have flexible schedule and fixed goals. But you cannot have fixed schedule and fixed goals, or flexible schedule and flexible goals. And I think we millennials are more of the flexible schedule, fixed goals.
Good.
Tell me exactly what you want from me, but don't bother me if I'm 15 minutes late or if I'm 15 minutes earlier, because that's my style as a millennial, I will stay more in the office.
Right.
And probably I'll be working on Saturdays and Sundays. So right. Time flexibility.
Great, great strategies. Did we cover all of them?
Last one, essential mentoring and coaching. Millennials are the generation that crave for mentoring and coaching. And the truth is, a lot of managers only supervise, only manage numbers. They don't try to understand the person. They don't try to train them in the techniques they gotta be trained. When you really become a mentor and a coach for your millennials, they become really, really loyal to you and to your company.
Great topics today. Dan Macias has been my guest today. Dan, give your contact information in case there's somebody who'd like to reach out to you.
Sure. So you can find me on social media as Dan Macias. Macias is M-A-C-I-A. And I'm like Dan Macias on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Instagram also. And if you want to shoot me an email, daniel.macias@sandler.com.
You've been a great guest today, Dan. Thank you so much. And thank you, listeners, for inviting us into your world. I'm Jim Stevens, and my calling is to challenge people to resist the status quo. Are you frustrated because you're living with just good enough, forced to accept chaos and volatility in daily business and customer relationships, anxious about your career of trial and error and learning the hard way? If you're ready to stand up to the insanity of programmed living, call me at 208-429-9275. That's 208-429-9275. Have a great weekend, and remember, if you measure it, you'll manage it.